Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And first up today is Phil Giraldi. He is the executive director of the Council for the National Interest. He writes for UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com, for antiwar.com, and also for the American Conservative Magazine. And Phil, before we get into the subject matter, let's talk a little bit about your upcoming event here with the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy on Reassessing America's Relationship with Israel at the National Press Club next month. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, it's going to be an all-day event on March 7th, which is a Friday. And it basically is four groups are sponsoring it, Washington Report Magazine being one of the others that some of your listeners are probably familiar with. And we're basically going to be looking at the Israeli-American relationship and various aspects of it. In other words, is it good for the United States? Is it bad for the United States? Should it be something different? We're going to be talking about a number of things, and we've assembled a panel that includes some very high-level people, including Stephen Walt, who was the co-author of the book on the Israel lobby, Harvard professor, Justin Raimondo, many of your listeners, I'm sure, is familiar with him, and there will be a panel that I will be on with four former CIA people on it. I think it's probably the first time in history four CIA people are caught together in one room.
Wow. Yeah, that's going to be something. I remember Christopher Ketchum wrote in Counterpunch. This is an essay that you're, or a news story that you're featured in as a source, but it begins, scratch a CIA agent, and he'll start telling you all about Israel's covert actions in the United States. And basically, this is a chip that all of you guys carry around on your shoulder. It's what you know about that none of the rest of us know about, what they're really up to here.
Well, you come to the summit, and you'll find out.
Wow, great. Okay, and this is on March the width, which?
March 7th. It's Friday, March 7th. There is a website you can go to, natsummit.org, which will give you all the information on speakers and how to register.
Okay, great. Yeah, and Karen Kotowski is going to be there and all kinds of others. Mm-hmm. That's going to be great. And now let me ask you this about this, too. You mentioned Stephen Walt there. It occurs to me that just for a long time, you just really could not get away with, in, you know, I guess, New York, D.C., polite society, with mentioning the influence of the Israel lobby over American foreign policy without the charge that you're an anti-Semite actually sticking. But then what happened was Walt and Mearsheimer wrote that book, The Israel Lobby, and they, it, you know, a lot of people attempted to smear them with that. They're both such, you know, reasonable gentlemen, basically just intellectual, you know, academic types with their academic realist foreign policy theories and all of that kind of thing. And they so obviously don't hold a grudge about this. They're just being honest, in a sense. And the fact that they weathered that storm, that really changed everything and made it possible for people to really be able to go ahead and talk about this. And
yeah,
maybe they'll still
really
smear us, but it doesn't really work anymore, does it?
Yeah, it really opened the door to the discussion. And now, of course, you have other people like Peter Beinart coming in on it, and Max Blumenthal in their recent books. Mm-hmm. And they have the advantage of actually being Jewish. And they are taking a hard, cold look at Israel. There's another book that just came out that I think the author's name is Judis, mm-hmm. J-U-D-I-S.
Yeah, from the New Republic.
Yeah, John Judis, about the years of Harry Truman and how what was then the kind of precursor liberal Israel lobby putting pressure on Harry Truman to create the State of Israel, even though he knew it was not in America's best interests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a good review of that by Scott McConnell in the American Conservative today, as a
right.
matter of fact. And by the way, just a slight footnote, since you brought him up, Judis is actually the author of a great piece from 1995, which unfortunately was a little bit premature. Its title, it was From Trotskyism to Anachronism, a biography of the neoconservative movement and how they were a bunch of nobodies that nobody ought to listen to ever again by 1995. But he wrote that for Foreign Affairs, and it's a great history of who these kooks are and how they came from the Trotskyite left to the Republican Party. And now, as you mentioned in your new article, which we're going to discuss here in a second, moving back again into working with the Democrats.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, essentially what we're looking at is a group that really has no anchor, has no fixed position, politically speaking, except being fanatical about Israel. And a lot of the other policies and everything that they shape around that fanaticism. In terms of domestic policies, I've known quite a few neocons, and they're liberal Democrats, essentially. I mean, you know, they're in favor of abortion, they're in favor of gay marriage, all the kind of touch stone issues that normally Republicans and conservatives shy away from.
Yeah, well, and on economic issues too. I mean, Irving Kristol wrote Two Cheers for Capitalism and all of that. So they've always been very regulatory statey and very welfare statey and all these things from the very beginning. Never changed that part of their stripes. They just thought the Republicans
That's
were
right.
better warmongers for the time being.
Yeah, and
basically.
big government all the way.
Yep. And so now, to be specific, Robert Kagan, who he's not just some neocon, he's really one of their intellectual leaders, I think. Not that they all agree on every little thing or whatever, but he's the co-author of Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy from 1996, calling for benevolent global hegemony with William Kristol, and you know, a great many works justifying neoconservative policies, especially the invasion of Iraq in 2003, of course, and staying the whole time, etc. And now it's his wife that's got us in all this trouble, or got herself in all this trouble, being caught on the phone plotting about who ought to be the next ruler of Ukraine. And in your article, you actually talk a little bit about her professional history and how it was that she came to have this position at this time. Can you go over a little bit of that for us?
Yeah, well, basically, I mean, she's a neocon, just like her husband. She, her great leap forward was essentially to work for Dick Cheney in the White House as his deputy national security advisor. And she was working for Scooter Libby, who was the national security advisor for Cheney. So it was all a kind of, cozy neocon arrangement. Kagan, one has to imagine, used his influence to get her the job. And then she basically was appointed ambassador to NATO again by Cheney Bush. After that, became State Department spokesman for Hillary Clinton, who of course is a Democrat, but is an extremely hawkish Democrat. And I think you basically would have to say that Hillary Clinton has this pretty much the same foreign policy as Kagan.
Yeah.
And so she, it, you know, some of the articles say, oh, well, she's comfortable with Democrats and Republicans. Well, that's one way to look at it. But the other way to look at it is that essentially she's far right in terms of her foreign policy views. And there's a constituency in both parties for that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the way I always put it is the centrists are the true extremists. You're more likely to find someone who is, you know, outside of the consensus to the good on the right and the left, but you always have a conservative Democrat like Hillary Clinton or a liberal Republican like John McCain in the center who are for every mad policy that anyone with any principle at all would oppose, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a mishmash of people in the middle that kind of swing one way or the other, depending on what the issue is, but really have no fixed viewpoints apart from this generic America is the kingmaker, and we have the right to intervene and be aggressive. I mean, that's both a Republican and a Democratic thing.
Mm-hmm. All right, now so take us back to the 1990s when. You know, after the Soviet Union fell apart, I mean, it was gone Christmas Day, 1991. It was a thing of the past with the resignation of Gorbachev. And then how long did it take to incorporate how many of these Eastern European states now into NATO, Phil?
Well, it's they're all they're all in NATO now, more or less. The only ones that still have not been officially brought in are the ones that are right on the border of the Soviet Union, or of Russia, of the former part of the Soviet Union. And that would mean Ukraine and Georgia, basically. The others are all now part of NATO. There was an agreement as the Soviet Union was breaking up that NATO and the United States would not take advantage of the situation and would not push NATO eastward. And yet, in spite of that, we basically broke the understanding. And this is, to a large extent, explains why Putin basically is as, shall we say, hostile towards us at times. It explains why it happened.
All right. Now, so what is the American interest in, why do they care that much about Ukraine that they're willing to go to this much trouble, as you mentioned? As is to be expected, you have American-backed NGOs, basically, so-called smart power, color revolution stuff going on here, backing the protesters. What's so important about Ukraine?
Well, I don't think there is anything that really is important in terms of a U.S. national interest. I think that essentially what we're seeing is more of this pushing towards the east, pushing against Russia, and Ukraine is becoming kind of the guy in the middle in this process, where the United States is insisting that the Ukraine become more Western European, and the leadership, which was elected in a fair election, of Ukraine has been saying that we get a better deal from closer ties with Russia. So it's that kind of situation. But the United States doesn't really have a big horse to play in this race. I don't really get most of it, but going back to what we started out talking about, the neocons have this thing about Russia. And there are probably a lot of different ways to define it or to explain it, but the fact is, you see John McCain doing this all the time, there are constant attacks on Russia, which are not really in our interest as a country. Our interest is to have a good relationship with Russia, and yet they're constantly banging on Russia, both in Congress and in the media, and even in the coverage we're seeing over the last week and a half of the Olympic Games. They're like, Russia is the enemy.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, I guess, I don't know, I was too young maybe in 1980 where they had the Olympics in the Soviet Union? Did they have that much open disdain, or were they pretending to be polite back then?
Well, the argument then, now this is when you talk about irony, the argument in 1980, and I remember it well because I was overseas with the agency and this was a big issue. We were running all kinds of propaganda against the Russians and even including T-shirts to embarrass them and that kind of thing. But the fact is that the argument was that the Russians, my God, were in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. They boycotted them back then, right.
That was the argument. And now here we have the United States, and we're all over the goddamn place. And we're being condescending towards Russia, saying that the Russians, because they have laws against homosexuality, and because Putin has anti-democratic tendencies, therefore there was a call to boycott the Olympics for that reason. So and as they say, the media and everybody else has been on the Russian case ever since.
Yeah, it seems like they could lighten up now 25 years after the end of the Cold War, but maybe not. All right, hang tight. We got to take this stupid break, and then we'll be back with Phil Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest right after this. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're at the Liberty Express and Ron Paul, Daily Paul Radio and all that. Yeah, Anomaly Radio, ScottHorton.org. Phil Giraldi's on the phone. We're talking about American intervention in Ukraine. They've got what amounts to at least a citywide civil war going on right now. It looks like, the government versus the protesters. I don't know if there are mobs out on the side of the government at this point, but things are looking pretty hairy in Kiev. And And, of course, this is in the, all in the context, and this is just part of being a Syrian or being a Ukrainian or anywhere else in the world. If you're from a small, weak state, then you don't really get to have domestic policies that aren't wrapped up in the games of foreign empires. And so, you know, whichever side these people on are on, even if it's just their own side, they're in effect on our side or on the Russian side in this too. And so, anyway, in that phone call between Victoria Nuland and with Jeffrey, whatever, the ambassador to Ukraine there, Phil, when they were talking about F the EU, we want to have this guy instead of that guy. What exactly was the dispute there? Do you know, was it that these two guys had, because they were both from the opposition, the two guys that they were arguing about should be, you know, in order of rank there, in joining the coalition government with the Yushchenko or whatever. But so I wonder, what was the big deal there? Do you know? Because I read this thing by this Yale fella, Wallerstein, Emmanuel Wallerstein, who said that he thought that for some reason that this represented the American fear that the German pick was actually someone that was closer to the Russian position. But that didn't seem to make sense to me, but I don't know.
Well, what I've heard is that the issue with the Europeans was that the Europeans were not moving fast enough to support the opposition. That's what I heard. Now, the other issue is that there were two opposition potential candidates, and the issue was that, again, this is my understanding, that Nuland and the ambassador were discussing which one would be a more viable candidate. Neither one obviously is an independent player. They're both looking for U.S. support on this. One of them is an ex-professional boxer, Klitschko, and they were basically saying that he might not be as viable a candidate because of his background, one would suspect, as the other guy. But basically, this is the United States talking about, you know, replacing a regime, right, or replacing the government with a candidate of its choice, and talking very confidently about going about and doing this.
But not really having a split with the Germans other than how to get it done right. Where's your efficiency? Get it, you know, glue this thing together.
Yeah, it was a tactical, dispute. But the fact is that the United States and the Germans and others have been pouring millions of dollars into supporting the opposition in the Ukraine and, you know, other places also, like Belarus. And, you know, this is an ongoing job for the National Endowment for Democracy and other NGOs supported by the U.S. government and others that are essentially in the regime change business. They wrap it up by saying we're bringing in democracy, but, you know, every time they claim to bring in democracy, they bring in a new gang of crooks that are exactly the same as the old gang, except generally they speak better English because they know they have to get their, you know, they have to meet with the ambassador and they have to get their points across. Right. It's ridiculous.
Well, you talked about how they're legitimately democratically elected as far as that goes. Yeah, and they defeated the guys that we installed in the last push in 2004, right? That was
That's
who
exactly
they
right.
finished creaming, cleaning the clock of was Timoshenko. The gas princess.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's like, it's almost like the Ukrainians have no say in this matter. It's a question of who the United States wants them to have and what kind of government they want them to have. But the irony, of course, is the United States is incapable of doing this kind of thing. We're not as good as the British and the French were, you know, around 100 years ago. We can't quite get it right. We go and we mess everything up. And then 6 months later, it's still a mess. And you see that in the Arab Spring where we got, unfortunately, involved. You see that all over Eastern Europe where the pastel revolutions have basically failed, all of them. And it's just, you know, it should be a joke. But Victoria Nuland and these other people that are well-placed in State Department and in policymaking, unfortunately, keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again.
Yeah, well, and, you know, you mentioned in your article John McCain's statement that we're all Georgians now, back during the crisis of 2008, where Georgia started it and was trying to get America to back them up in a war with Russia. John McCain, boy, it was a good thing that guy wasn't in charge then. I mean, he was still just running for president at the time, but still. But anyway, what's funny about that to me, of course, is that you know, again, I'm just from Texas, so when somebody says former Soviet Georgia, I mean, I know where it is now, but, you know, before the last decade of study of American foreign policy, I mean, that's the hinterlands. That's the far end of the earth where no one from anywhere around me has the slightest idea where that is. It is almost just to say, not Georgia, Georgia, former Soviet Georgia. I mean, something that is so far removed from your life, it could not possibly be any of your government's business. It has nothing to do with anything going on around here at all. I mean, who's got even the slightest business tie to former Soviet Georgia other than, you know, Lockheed?
Well, we know that John McCain's foreign policy advisor had a consulting fee, shall we say, for the Republic of Georgia. Yeah. I wonder if that had anything to do with it.
Yeah, Randy Scheuneman there. And right, yeah, you know, right. I mean, they said it was Susskind said that Dick Cheney was pushing. I guess there are multiple reports of this, actually. Two or three different reports said that Dick Cheney was pushing George Bush to do something about it. Let's hit the Russians in the tunnels where their tanks and trucks are coming under the Caucasus Mountains.
Right. Yep.
Which, you know, I mean, a slight risk of a hydrogen bomb exchange, but not that big of a deal, probably.
Well, for Cheney, it would be okay. He had probably a bomb shelter over here at the secret White House in Virginia, and so he would probably not be hurt.
Location, yeah. All right. Well, and speaking of which, I saw McCain on one of these hairdos. I forgot his name on CNN yesterday. Anderson Cooper, interviewing John McCain, and. You know, of course, and this is the same no matter what they're talking about, if it was a Social Security question or whatever. The construct of the question can only be, you know, so run-on sentency like mine. They set it up so very briefly. So there's a lot of killing going on in Syria. Sometimes the good guys kill people, but other times, Mr. McCain, the bad guys kill people too. So what do we do? Well, the answer is, well, we got to back the moderates, who are against both sets of bad guys. It's a two-front war, that's right, and so we gotta back them good, said John McCain. So my question to you is, how feasible is it that we can prop up an army? I mean, assuming they really started now, and I know you've been reporting since December 2011 that Obama had signed findings authorizing covert action in Syria and stepping up support for these kooks and all that. But what if they started now and they really spent the money and put the equipment down and tried to train up an army of moderate Sunni jihadi fighters to take on ISIS and to take on the Baathist government? You know, if John McCain paid you $1 billion to make it happen, Phil, how long would it take you to win the war? What would it look like?
Well, you basically have to recruit a force of mercenaries. That's the only way you would win it.
And because, how many would you need?
There's no indigenous moderate force there. I mean, you know, they've kind of been subsumed in various directions, and you have the crazies, and you have the government, which is increasingly ruthless, and people in the middle are getting ground down. I don't think there's any way to do what McCain is talking about apart from recruiting a considerable force of mercenaries, maybe training them in Jordan or Saudi Arabia, and then shipping them over under European and American officers and with air support and doing it that way. It's just these things are impossible. You can't identify the moderates. You can't take the time to properly train them or anything like that. It's just the whole concept is ridiculous.
Well, and isn't that what ISIS is? The mercenary army sent by the Americans and the Saudi Arabians?
Well, ISIS has its own agendas, I think, too, clearly, and is certainly supported by the Saudis. The extent to which it's supported by the United States is probably considerably less. But, there are a whole bunch of players right now that essentially are running around, with their own agendas and just killing each other. It's the whole thing is obscene. There was some video showing on The Guardian today about the extremist occupied part of Syria. I think the city was called Raqqa. And they were talking about how they are enforcing Sharia law to an extreme level, including stoning women to death and that sort of thing. And there are no good guys over there. And John McCain sure as hell is not a good guy.
Yeah, well, you know, when he went over there, it was his own people. It was, in fact, Elizabeth Obagi, the fake PhD student scandal girl. She was the source. It wasn't like an anonymous source claims. It was his entourage just said out loud, no problem, to the Daily Caller that, yeah, McCain wanted to have a pajama party and spend the night with the Northern Storm Brigade, but his security detail had to talk him out of it. And then if you just Google Northern Storm Brigade, Time Magazine's got video of him saying, yeah, we fought in the Iraq War against the Americans. These are the guys that he was palling around with, and they were the kidnappers of a bunch of Shiite pilgrims from Lebanon and stuff. These are the moderates he wants to back. Amazing. Yeah. All right. And you should have seen it, because on CNN, this is just the conventional wisdom. Yeah, we got to back the moderates. Everybody knows that, the moderates. All right. Thanks, Phil. Moderate. Appreciate it.
All right, Scott. Take care.
That's Phil Giraldi. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for thebumpersticker.com. I created it but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. Thebumpersticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. Thebumpersticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police, state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.